Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're heading straight into the heart of material science, into the world of ultra-high-strength steel design. And this isn't just about making things strong. It's really about achieving what has historically been, well, a paradox in metallurgy.
It really is. The goal is designing materials that are simultaneously incredibly strong and incredibly tough.
Which for centuries was seen as impossible.
A complete trade-off, yeah.
Yeah.
You gain one, you lose the other. This whole deep dive is built around some really seminal theoretical work, a 1979 PhD dissertation.
79, wow.
It's called The Theory and Significance of Retained Austenite in Steels. I mean, this document is one of the foundations of how we design high-performance alloys today.
That's just fascinating. So we're talking about research from almost 50 years ago that's still defining how we build cars, build infrastructure right now.
It is.
So our mission, then, is to move beyond just trial and error. We're going to unpack the really complex mechanics of phase transformations.
Things like bainite and martensite.
Right, and understand how precise control over these tiny trapped microstructures can lead to predictable, superior materials.
It's the transition from, let's try this recipe and see what happens, to, okay, based on calculated thermodynamics, this is the microstructure we will get, and this is exactly how it's going to perform.
Okay, let's unpack this, starting with what you've called one of the most controversial and just stubbornly complex transformation reactions in material science, bainite.
Bainite.
Why is it such a mystery?
Well, because it sits right in this middle ground. It's the least understood of the major decomposition reactions in steels because it has characteristics of both high-temperature slow reactions and low-temperature rapid ones.
Yeah.
It's not fully one or the other.
And that ambiguity, I take it, fueled this huge debate for decades, diffusional versus displacive.
That's the one.
Can you walk us through those two main schools of thought on how bainite actually forms?
Absolutely. So the first camp, they championed the diffusional or reconstructive model. They argued that bainite forms like other high-temperature phases. That means atoms, specifically carbon and iron, they have to move over relatively large distances.
So everything is shuffling around.
Right. It's an arrangement that happens via a ledge mechanism, which is similar to Wittgenstein ferrite, if you're familiar. It takes time, it takes high temperatures, and relies on the rearrangement of both the iron and the carbon.
So it's like slow, meticulous brick stacking, atom by atom.
That's a great analogy. But then you have the other school of thought, the displacive or shear model.
The radical idea.
The radical idea. It says the structure forms through this cooperative, almost instantaneous shear movement of iron atoms into their new lattice. They keep their neighbors, more or less.
Wow.
And the critical constraint then becomes how fast the carbon can get pushed out of this new structure and into the surrounding austenite.
So that sounds like a violent, high-speed, just slam dunk of a phase transformation, which then has to wait for a sort of carbon cleanup crew.
It is. And this high-speed shear mechanism is really the only way to explain a crucial observation that the diffusional model just cannot handle.
Yeah, that is.
The incomplete reaction phenomenon.
Ah, tell us about that, because this failure to complete the reaction is the proof of the mechanism itself, isn't it?
It's the smoking gun.
Mm-hmm.
If you hold steel at the right temperature for bainite to form, the reaction, it just stops. It quits.
Even with plenty of time.
Even with plenty of time and plenty of material left to transform, thermodynamically speaking. And this leaves behind what we call retained austenite. Austenite that was expected to transform but didn't.
And if the diffusional model, the brick stacking model, were correct, given enough time, the whole thing should transform. It should go to 100% completion.
It absolutely should, but it doesn't. And that incomplete reaction can only be understood if you think about the thermodynamic constraints of a displacive transformation. This is all linked to a critical temperature boundary. It's called Toddahl.
Do our dollar. How does that act as the ultimate thermodynamic traffic cop here?
So Toddahl represents the temperature where austenite and the new ferrite phase, with the exact same composition, are in a kind of metastable equilibrium.
Okay.
Because the bainite transformation starts while this extra carbon trapped inside, that's the shear part, it can only happen below this Toddahl. As it transforms, that excess carbon gets squeezed out and builds up in the remaining austenite.
So the untransformed austenite just gets richer and richer in carbon.
Precisely. And that carbon enrichment actually shifts the dollar boundary.
Yeah.
So eventually the carbon concentration in that leftover austenite gets so high that the free energy difference between the parent and the product drops to zero.
And the driving force is gone.
The thermodynamic driving force for the shear mechanism is gone. The transformation throttles down and it stops. incomplete. So the retained austenite, you see, it isn't a flaw. It's a required, predictable result of the shear process itself.
So the steel is thermodynamically stuck. The transformation stops not because diffusion ran out of time, but because the chemical energy balance just hit a stalemate.
Exactly.
Okay, so now we understand the mechanism. This challenge is obviously control. And this is where it gets really interesting. How do you control this to engineer the perfect microstructure?
This is where we introduce the silicon solution. The experimental alloy in this foundational work was very specific. F0.43C 3.00 Mn2.12 Si.
That's a lot of silicon.
A lot. Oh. Over 2%. And it's the critical ingredient here. It has a unique property. It actively and very powerfully inhibits the formation of cementite.
Which is iron carbide.
Iron carbide, yes. And blocking that carbide formation is just crucial for this whole process.
Why? What does stopping the carbide do?
Because cementite precipitation is the normal escape route for carbon. Usually, carbon leaves the new structure and forms these tiny carbide particles. Mm. But if you block that route with silicon,
you force all that excess carbon to stay trapped in the remaining austenite.
You've got it. So silicon essentially forces the steel to follow that displacive pathway, which stabilizes the retained austenite and makes sure that incomplete reaction sticks around long enough for us to use it.
And the manganese is there, too, just playing a supporting role.
Right. It helps stabilize the untransformed austenite even further. And by controlling the temperature, they can produce two really distinct forms of bainite in these high silicon steels.
Let's break that down. What's the difference between upper and lower bainite in this specific steel?
Okay, so upper bainite that forms at higher temperatures. In it, you see these aggregates of bainitic ferrite laths, and they're separated by these thin films of carbon-enriched retained austenite.
The good stuff.
The good stuff. And crucially, there is no detectable carbide precipitation. This is the direct result of the silicon. It worked. We successfully blocked the normal carbide.
So silicon worked perfectly in the upper phase. What about lower bainite, which forms at cooler temperatures?
In a lower phase, they did see some precipitation. But again, this just highlights the incredible chemical complexity. It wasn't standard cementite. The research identified a completely new non-standard carbide phase with a complex monoclinic structure. It shows that silicon didn't just stop all carbon from escaping. It forced the system to create a fundamentally new atomic configuration, probably some kind of iron, silicon, manganese carbide, just to deal with the high carbon activity.
So the carbon found a back door because the main door was locked.
A very good way to put it.
And this brings us right to the retained austenite itself. It's the star of the show, but you said it has a split personality.
It really does. It exists in two very different forms or morphologies. First, the one you want. Thin, highly stable, highly carbon-enriched films trapped between the ferrite laths.
And the second?
The second is the detrimental form. Larger, less enriched, blocky islands.
And the films are what deliver these spectacular properties we're talking about. They're responsible for the transformation-induced plasticity, the TRI-P effect.
That's it. When you put the steel under stress, these stable films don't just break. Instead, they incrementally transform into tough, strong martensite. And in doing so, they absorb energy and stop cracks from spreading. It radically improves toughness.
But the blocky stuff.
The blocky austenite is a weakness. It's unstable, it doesn't have that high carbon stabilization, and it transforms into brittle martensite almost immediately under stress, which, you know, just accelerates failure.
So the ultimate design goal isn't just making strong steel, it's controlling the microstructure to maximize the ratio of that stable film austenite to the unstable blocky stuff.
That ratio maximization is the key. And here's where we hit this fantastic synergy. Let's talk about strength for a second. The calculated yield stress for this unique bainitic ferrite structure was about 1,440 megapascals.
1,440 MPa, that's astonishingly high. To put that in context for everyone listening, how does that compare?
Well, it tells us that the mechanism we designed for toughness is also secretly providing superior strength.
Yeah.
Lath martensite, you know, the gold standard for high strength, in a similar composition, yields at about 1,000 MPa. We were talking about a 440 MPa jump.
Yeah.
And the research attributes this huge increase directly to the presence of those retained austenite films.
How does the film increase strength if its main job is toughness and ductility?
The films act as these incredibly effective dislocation barriers.
Okay.
Dislocation movement is how steel deforms plastically. These films are believed to be already jammed with dislocations from the shear formation process. So when a moving dislocation hits the boundary of that austenite film, it's extremely difficult for it to transfer into the next ferrite unit. It makes the boundary super strong.
That's a profound detail. The toughening phase provides massive, unexpected hardening by acting as a kind of molecular speed bump to deformation.
It's the elegance of predictive materials design. And to push the transformation even further to get more of those films, they looked at shifting that $2 curve again.
How do you do that?
You can add other strategic elements, like nickel. In the Finney C. alloy results, they show that nickel allows the austenite to hold even more carbon before the thermodynamic driving force for the reaction just terminates.
So speaking of these displacive transformations, let's zoom in on martensite for a moment and see how its formation mechanics tie back to our central goal, which is stabilizing that retained austenite.
Right. Martensite is the quintessential displacive transformation. And when you study lower alloy martensites, you often see twinning, the formation of these crystallographic twins, inside the structure.
And originally people thought that was just part of the process.
They did. But the analysis here suggested something else entirely. It concluded that these twins are primarily an accommodation effect.
What does that mean?
Martensite forms these units, or laths, at incredibly high velocity. This creates huge localized strains. So when these newly formed units collide with each other, what they call high-velocity impingements, the twins form to manage and accommodate the strain from that collision.
So the twins are like internal structural shock absorbers, just managing the stress of this rapid atomic rearrangement.
Precisely. And the orientation relationship between the parent austenite and the new martensite is critical. The research established that only the Kojimov-Sachs, or KS, orientation relationship.
That's the specific geometric alignment between the two crystal lattices.
Yes, only that specific alignment allows for the formation of these twin-related martensite variants.
And why is that so important for the final material?
Because forming these mutually oriented variants promotes the maximum possible strain accommodation across all the boundaries. And by relieving those internal stresses, you mechanically stabilize the thin retained austenite films that are trapped between the laths.
Ah, so it all connects.
It all connects. Whether it's bainite or martensite, managing that internal stress through this geometric accommodation is how you make sure the retained austenite survives, stable, and ready to do its job.
This level of detail must require incredible measurement tools. They had to confirm the precise habit plane, right? The actual interface?
It's microscopic geometry. And it's extremely difficult to determine accurately, but they use techniques like computer-aided trace normal analysis. By minimizing the scatter of great circles from many measurements, they could confirm the habit planes were near very specific orientations, like 1310.
So this wasn't guesswork. This was mathematically proving the crystallographic pathway of the transformation.
Which is the foundation of moving from empirical observation to fully predictive theory.
Okay, let's bring this down to earth. How does this theoretical deep dive impact real-world things that you might see every day?
Well, this connects directly to dual phase, or DP, steels. These are foundational materials used everywhere in automotive applications today as a superior substitute for conventional HSLA steels.
High strength, low alloy.
Right. They're prized because they give you high strength combined with fantastic formability. So car makers can press complex shapes while keeping the material light and strong.
And silicon is a key player in DP steels as well, I imagine.
It is. In DP steels, silicon increases the overall strength. It raises the critical tensile to yield stress ratio. But crucially, it eliminates a huge manufacturing headache, discontinuous yielding.
What is that, and why do engineers hate it so much?
Discontinuous yielding results in something called stretcher strain markings when you're forming a part, like stamping a car door. They're these ugly, localized deformation lines. They require expensive post-processing to get rid of. By adding silicon, you eliminate that phenomenon entirely. The steel forms cleanly and uniformly. It's a huge practical advantage.
So to make sure this new theory actually held up in these complex real-world microstructures, the researchers had to test different deformation models.
Exactly. You can't predict performance if your model assumes the steel acts uniformly when it clearly doesn't.
So what did they test?
They compared two prominent models. First was Mylitko's theory. It assumes that the strain distribution across the whole microstructure is more or less homogeneous.
That everything stretches the same amount.
Right. And for this complex, high-silicon, dual-phase alloy, Mylitko's theory gave poor agreement. It just didn't work.
Because the assumption of simple, uniform stretching in this mixed material was a fatal flaw.
It was. The strain in DP steels is highly inhomogeneous. Some parts deform a lot more than others. The superior model was Tomoda's theory.
And that was different how?
It's a more generalized approach. It specifically accounts for internal stresses and for that inhomogeneous deformation between the soft ferrite and the hard martensite phases. And Tomoda's model achieved excellent agreement with the experimental data. It was far more predictive.
So the overall synthesis is clear. By rigorously characterizing this bainite mechanism, especially its displacive nature and that incomplete reaction, we can predict and design these high-performance silicon bainite microstructures. We are now replacing expensive traditional trial and error with precise calculated materials engineering.
And we connect this to the bigger picture. I mean, the ultimate elegance here is that we can design a steel that delivers incredible strength and toughness using carbon.
The cheapest alloying element there is.
Exactly. The cheapest stabilizer known. And we avoid carbon's bad side, like carbide embrittlement, just by controlling where the carbon ends up and how the transformation proceeds. All with a bit of silicon and precise temperature control, grounded in thermodynamic principles.
So what does this all mean for you? It means the next time you step into a modern, fuel-efficient car or see a high-performance piece of machinery, that incredible structural integrity isn't an accident. It's based on this fundamental science, the purposeful creation of a dual-phase steel designed to stop transforming just short of completion, all thanks to a theory finalized decades ago.
And, you know, we've established that this incomplete reaction and the performance of bainite are consistent with a displacive shear mechanism. But for the theory to be truly finalized, the precise nature of the transformation interfaces, whether they glide continuously, what we call glissal, or move via a continuous nucleation, the pole mechanism, that needs to be definitively characterized.
Which subtle boundary dynamics are truly controlling the transformation of the next generation of materials? That's something for you to mull over as you enjoy your newly acquired expertise.